This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families, sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au, a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
You gotta see the baby. When are you gonna see the baby?
Family Matters.
It is Family Matters, and if you're listening to the fantastic crew on Stand Up Straight, they refer to us as a cooking show.
A cooking show. Well, tonight we're talking about cooking. And
I thought we were making turkey.
That's what there's I heard. Oven, there's seasoning.
There's a bun of some description.
Now we welcome Beck, who's following up from Stand Up Straight, and the one and only Mama Mish.
Hello, hello, hello.
And you're Dave.
No, tonight I'm the very lovely producer, David.
Producer David.
Even though
are
I've
you?
Done nothing really to produce the show.
Do you think you're the boss of us now?
Yeah.
Well,
that
you're
mic
not.
I can turn off at any time.
I know Gina's listening and she told me I could be the boss.
Yeah.
She, always.
She was.
Mama Mish, we've got a pre-record coming up today with Dr.
Ruth McNair.
That's right. And what are we talking about? A lot of topics that I
turkey basting
no idea about.
So, Dave, tell me three things you know about ovulation.
It's a cycle of some sort.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is something to do with eggs.
Yeah.
And women.
Well, that's actually not too bad.
Is that okay?
Not too far off. For a gay man, he's doing okay.
Yeah, actually. For a gay man, because, you know, I imagine you don't come into contact with ovulation very often. So, no, well done, Dave. Three out of three for ovulation school.
I seem to every time I go to the toilet at work, though. It's not nice. It's horrible.
Yes, well.
I could go way back.
Now, quickly switching gears. Switching gears now. High Court Challenge. You're the resident lawyer, Beck. What's happening in that space?
Yes. So we've got the High Court Challenge against the plebiscite led by politician Andrew Wilkie, our friend Felicity Marlowe, and a whole lot of other wonderful people.
And for all those people playing at home, can you break it down a bit more?
What's the results? What's the where's the avenues going?
Well, nothing's happened at the moment. Basically, we are trying to stop the postal plebiscite. It's a challenge in the High Court. So they had a hearing last week and I went down. There was a group of supporters and we stood outside and
yes.
waved and cheered, yep. which was great. And so they're back in court for a hearing, which has been confirmed on Tuesday, the 5th of September. So it's going to be going all day, but we're really encouraging people to come down to where the High Court is, which is at 305 William Street, corner of William and Lonsdale, near the park, just to have a bit of a gathering there, support for the case. I went down there the other week and I had my little rainbow and lots of people had rainbows. So as many people as possible that can get down there. We'll remind people again before the 5th of September.
So what can we achieve? The postal plebiscite can be thrown out on Tuesday.
Yeah.
The kids are all right. As for our presenters, Family Matters, Joy 94.9.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Ruth McNair. Ruth's worked as a GP since 1993 all around Melbourne and various other places in Australia. She completed a PhD in lesbian and bisexual women's health in 2009 and has an interest in women's health, including lesbian and bisexual women's health, trans health, mental health and wellbeing, adolescent health, fertility and pregnancy care, and is accredited as an antenatal shared care provider. We were lucky enough to have Dr. Ruth bust for us some of the myths about home insemination.
The one topic we haven't touched on yet, and we're a year old, is home insemination. So we've talked a lot about transfertility, we've done surrogacy, we've done the difference between IUI and IVF with a fertility doctor.
We've grazed on this a little bit.
A little bit. I was coming up with the questions going, wow, I don't know where to go with this.
which is why we're doing this episode.
It is why we're doing this episode.
Well,
yeah.
This is like a consultation that I would have with a person or a couple.
Pretend we've got a lesbian couple. me and Michelle. We're coming Michelle out. Is a trans woman. But, you know, say we've got a lesbian couple and we've had the conversation, we've found a known donor.
Can I carry the baby? Yeah. Okay.
We know who the donor is and we've decided not to go down the clinical route, mm-hmm. and we want to do it ourselves. We want to try the home insemination path first.
And we got a host, we get the birth mother, you've got all sperm that donor. You've had the conversations, et cetera.
So all the legal and all that sort of stuff, we, you know, they've listened to Family Matters, they've done their research and they know what to do there. Before we get started with the process, what preparation should both the birth mother and the sperm donor possibly do before getting started? Is there health preparation? Are there health tests? Where should they really start?
Yep. Okay, so the birth mother, it's really good to do some pre-pregnancy blood tests, and that's to check for a whole range of things that would be beneficial to be, you know, good during pregnancy. So things like being immune to rubella, chickenpox, what's the blood count, what's the iron level, how's the thyroid function, what's their blood group. So we can do all of that as a blood test before pregnancy, and if anything needs correcting, you know, iron levels or an immunisation for rubella, all of those things could be done well before pregnancy. So that's a really useful thing to start with, you know, making sure they're up to date and basically being sure that the general health and well-being is as good as it can get. I do a little bit of discussion about health and fitness, you know, optimising weight, be it too low or too high, just making it as good as you can get it, because all of that helps with fertility, optimising diet, so making sure that the nutrition is excellent because that optimises fertility in terms of the egg quality. So we can do all of that as a useful pre-pregnancy check. Secondly, around fertility itself, I like people to monitor their cycle, their menstrual cycle, to look at how often they're having periods and therefore how often they're ovulating, to get a sense of whether they have any symptoms of ovulation, things like sticky egg white sort of mucus, ovulation pain. So that's all useful to monitor because a lot of people have never really taken much notice of it. It's a good chance over a 3 or 4 month period to just see what's happening with their body. Because with home insemination, it's really important to get the timing right with ovulation and insemination. So getting to know your body and understanding when you might be ovulating is really important.
I've seen with the fertility doctors, they give women something to make sure they ovulate or hold off ovulation. Is there like a pee test or something a woman can do from home?
Yeah. So there's a urine test that measures the LH or the luteinizing hormone, and that is the hormone that goes up about 24 to 36 hours before you ovulate. It triggers ovulation naturally. So you can measure that in urine, and you could do your urine test 3 or 4 days before you expect to be ovulating, which is mid-cycle, midway between the periods, to be sure that you're getting it right with your other signs that you might have anyway in your body. So it's really helpful to have done that 2 or 3 cycles and just see if you can get a positive result on the urine test and know your timing for insemination.
With these things from doing the home tests, is there things that people sort of overlook or miss out on that ends up actually having a lot of fails? Is there something that people just don't do that are common mistakes?
Yeah.
I mean, I think the main one is sort of feeling like you can be hit and miss with ovulation. So some people say to donors, oh, look, we'll just inseminate every night for a week around mid-cycle. And firstly, that's not necessarily going to work. And secondly, it can wear out your donor pretty much within the first month.
I was going to say, it sounds like it sounds like a good thing for most heterosexual couples, but probably not so much from this case.
No, because, you know, it's pretty inconvenient for everyone to get your donor either coming to your house or rushing over to their house to pick up some samples every day. And I think, you know, I model this on what the clinics would do with intrauterine insemination. They monitor the ovulation and pick one time, the optimal time to do the insemination, and that would be within the 24 hours of ovulation because you only produce that egg once in a cycle. It lasts for about 24 hours itself and then it dies. So So you can either have the sperm in just about when you're ovulating or a few hours before. So there's an optimal window.
When it comes to the sample of what you're putting in, okay, so the sperm we're putting in, is there a certain amount that should be going at a time, like in this particular case, or is it a little bit will do, or does it need to be so many mils in a cup, or how much do you need?
Yeah. Well, really, it's just the whole sample. Whatever the donor can produce from that one sample should all go in. I mean, most of that is semen. There's hopefully at least 20 million sperm in there as well per mil. So, you know, and sperm donors have a really wide range of volumes of their ejaculate. So some get down to about 2 mils and others it might be 5 or 6 mils. So the actual amount of ejaculate doesn't really matter. What matters is you get it all in because you want to get all of the sperm from that sample in.
With the women's test, so, you know, you were saying iron and just, you know, obviously her own tests, so I assume the known donor should also be having tests as well, sexual yeah. health tests, that sort of stuff. What sort of tests would you recommend a known donor go for? And would you also recommend their partner, if they have one, also be tested at the same time?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing we worry most about is, number one, is the donor fertile? And a lot of men assume they're fertile, but they've never actually had a sperm test.
Okay.
So that's a really helpful thing for them to do at the beginning of the negotiation. And if their sperm test is low or, you know, has a low fertility, then they could get some fertility advice themselves through the medical system. Also, the second thing we worry about is whether the sperm might be carrying an STI. Mm-hmm. So it could carry chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, HIV, hepatitis through the semen. So this is a really important safety issue for the donors and for the recipient, to be sure the donor is safe in terms of their lifestyle, so they're not going to catch anything for the 3 months leading up to the blood test, because there is a window period where the results won't necessarily show up, even if the person is infected with one of these blood-borne viruses.
Okay.
So they need to be safe, have their test, and then negotiation around continuing to be safe for the whole time they're trying for pregnancy, which is a pretty tricky discussion to have with a donor.
Yeah.
You may not know that well, or it might be your partner's brother, or, you know, there are things that you don't normally discuss with people outside a sexual relationship.
So it's a big trust factor. It's
a really important one.
And a lot of it, it's surprising how much, how many of us actually aren't really educated about our own bodies, because so many men would go, well, I've ejaculated, here's all of it there. They people don't realize there's the difference between semen and sperm that's coming through there.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I mean, people ask me whether it's possible to have an HIV-positive donor, for example. Theoretically, these days it is possible, because first, a lot of HIV-positive people are on fantastic drugs that get their viral load really low.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, HIV, if it's going to be transmitted, it's in the semen, not the sperm. So it's possible to wash the sperm and to inseminate with that. So, you know, obviously they would have to go through a clinic to do that. But, you know, that's a really important difference. So, I mean, back to the donor testing, really what you're trying to get a donor to agree to is a sperm test, a urine test that would check for chlamydia and gonorrhea, and then a blood test that would check for the blood-borne viruses. Whether their partner, if they have a partner, whether they should be tested, well, yeah, I think so, because hopefully the two of them are being safe if they have other partners, but together they might not be using protection. So you want to be sure both people are safe.
I remember we interviewed a mum who was 37 weeks pregnant, and she went through the clinic method. But one of the reasons she chose that was because she herself had type 1 diabetes, and she wanted to make sure the donor as well didn't have that. Are there any of those kind of, you know, those kind of genetic tests that clinics seem to run that a couple, you know, just going to their GP and going to a blood clinic can also be mindful of getting checked in advance?
Yeah, and I mean, there's increasing amounts of information about the genetic testing, and they're getting more accurate as well. So at the moment, it partly relates to family history,
mm-hmm.
so that's helpful to look through the biological mum and also the donor's family history for inherited conditions like thalassemia, hemochromatosis, Down syndrome, spina bifida, So these are all things that can be tested through genetic testing to see if a person is a carrier for these conditions. Most important for people who have a family history, just in case they've inherited part of that genetic material.
Yeah.
You know, if, for example, some of these things are only a problem if both genetic materials from the male and the female carry the same abnormality. So that's the only time when a child might inherit that condition. So, you know, that's important to check with donors as well about their history.
Yeah.
Some people, whether or not they have a family history, would check for Down syndrome. You can't check Down syndrome, sorry. Let me think about this for a moment. Fragile X is a common one, and it's being increasingly promoted, if you like, as an important test as a pre-pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a very common inherited condition that causes intellectual disability and lots of other things, but people often don't know that it's in their family. So, you know, that can be done as a genetic test to see if you've got a possibility of passing that on to a child.
Now, speaking of genetic material, look, I produce two children the old-fashioned way. Now, I'm, you know, Jean and I hear two women talking about having children, and you hear the old story of the turkey baster. I am really curious.
And you're American, so you celebrate Thanksgiving. So yeah, you know what? Yeah. To be honest, never seen a turkey baster. I've never served turkey.
I'll bring it in next week.
I'm Greek. We eat lamb for Christmas. You know, there is no.
Yeah. So I have to. I have to.
Without the tools of the trade.
The tools of the trade.
What do we do?
What do we do?
Yep. All right. So it's really just a 5 mL syringe, which you know, you can purchase in pharmacies. People use them to give kids medicines, for example.
Okay.
So it doesn't have to be a mystery. You can just go and ask for it. You don't need a needle on the end or anything. It's just the syringe. So
yes, thank you. Let's clarify that. No needles needed. Yeah.
No needles. Nothing up. So really all it takes is drawing up the semen sample into that syringe and then squirting it into the vagina. That's the mechanics of it. I mean, there's a bit of work around where does your cervix sit in the vagina. Some people have a cervix that sits right up high, others it sits right behind, it's sort of low towards your back. So a lot of people think it's useful to lift the bottom on a pillow, you know, have it elevated after you've done the insemination so that the vagina is tilted backwards and that allows gravity to get the semen in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
It's helpful to do that for 20 to 30 minutes, you know. The sperm is mobile, it swims,
mm-hmm.
So we use nature here to, you know, it basically works its way towards the cervix and then through the cervix. So after about 20 or 30 minutes that's happened, the rest of the semen will just come out again, doesn't matter.
Now you're saying that where the angle of the cervix. Now, as reading, there was reading that you should spray away from the cervix, and I don't know how you would do that or what is this about?
Well, I mean, the risk would be if you insert the syringe too far, you know, you don't want to put pressure directly into the cervix because that could be quite painful and potentially cause a bit of a reaction. You can get a low blood pressure if your cervix is, you know, dilated unexpectedly. I think that would be really unlikely, though, because you're only putting the syringe in a couple of centimetres.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really matter what angle you squirt the semen, you know. Not going to do any damage. The main thing is, you know, keeping it down there for enough time for it to get through.
And I read, Michelle's laughing, because that's the thing. You go online and you go, what tips and tricks?
There's a lot of detail.
But you have to look. I was really scared writing these things.
Gina's got this. She's doing the motions, trying to figure out how to put this.
I use my hands. I'm Greek, and I'm just like trying to figure
it. Yeah, and she's trying to angle it, how to do it. And then you're saying, it's not going to do any damage. I'm going, unless it. And then my brain is inappropriate going, unless it's Superman semen.
No.
And that's just, you know.
But I even read somewhere it said you should even, when you're using the syringe, you should even release slowly and make sure, tap it and make sure there's no air bubbles. Like, apparently all this stuff.
That doesn't really matter. You know, there's plenty of air in the vagina.
Yeah.
So it really, all that matters is, you don't squirt it at a high pressure because, I guess, theoretically you could damage the sperm or squirt it directly onto the cervix. That might be pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But otherwise, just a gentle squirt, you're in and it's fine.
You're in, you're done. Is yep. there anything the guys should be depositing in, or as long as it is clean, it doesn't matter?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be sterile. Just a clean glass, plastic or drum jar is fine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay for a clean little sterile Vegemite jar.
There's a joke yeah. about a Vegemite jar from someone who did this 21 years ago, and Vegemite jar was the container of choice at
there
the time.
I mean, the main thing with the donation is that you keep the semen warm, because we don't want the sort of time lapse between ejaculation and insemination to be so long that the sperm has died. And, you know, the labs, when they do a sperm test, require it to be donated and delivered within 1 hour.
Okay.
That's because within that hour, so long as you keep the sample warm, the sperm is going to be viable.
That was definitely a question we were going to ask, because what if the donor cannot come over to your house and go into one room? And because a lot of the couples we've spoken to, they've done it at the home. One couple, you know, a couple's gone into one room and the gentleman and his partner have gone into another, and there's kind of been a fun exchange in a hallway.
Yeah,
but if they don't live together or they can't be in the same place, what is the maximum length of time without looking at a freezing method? Is it that 1 hour?
Yeah, 1 hour. That would be not
optimal.
A problem. Yeah. More than that might be losing its quality.
Yeah.
2 hours, absolutely maximum.
Yeah.
And so keeping it warm in a pocket, you know, okay. That's all you need to do. I knew one couple that had a very elaborate arrangement with a thermos flask and a temperature gauge, and I thought, no, you've just gone too far. You don't have to do all that. Just keep it warm in a pocket.
Yeah.
It's fine. Yeah.
Fantastic. So yeah, no hot water bottle, none of that sort of.
So we don't have to go. So there's no frozen in an ice cube tray, none of that stuff.
No. Yeah, there was a joke about Dave doing.
I mean, in a home situation, you can't freeze them to an adequate temperature. So yeah, we don't go down that track either.
So okay, so they've been able to within the hour transfer. Do the process. I'm so terrible with the lingo, and I think I'm more scared of the lingo than so we've done the insemination. Great. Everyone's happy. Everyone's gone home. She's laying on her back for about 20 minutes. All good to go. When should the woman start having pregnancy test to see if it was successful?
2 weeks, and then the urine pregnancy test usually starts showing a positive at about 2 weeks post-insemination. So that would be helpful. You can also do a blood test around then, which will be a bit more accurate.
We've also seen, you mentioned earlier frozen is not really an option. Is a lot of what we read online mentions frozen. Is that because then you're really involving a clinic when you're looking at frozen?
Yeah, exactly. So, and it has been, I mean, in the States, that's been quite a common method to freeze, known donors to freeze sperm and then take it home. You know, it falls out on the way home and you do it at home. A clinic here was offering that service quite a few years. I don't think they are offering it anymore, so that, you know, people could get their donor to freeze the sperm and they could not be in the clinic situation for the insemination. Now, if you do have a known donor through the clinic and the sperm is frozen, they require you to go into the clinic to do the insemination, so it becomes more clinical again.
You've had couples obviously come to you, so I assume most people will go to a GP. Is that correct? They'll come?
No, I think a lot of people in the past, a lot of people worried that they didn't know whether it was legal, they didn't know whether the GP would report them or would sort of give them a hard time. So, I mean, in recent years, it's obviously been legal since 2010, 2009, I think, the legislation. Where it was officially recorded as a legal thing to do. So that's not a problem anymore. But I think there are still people who aren't sure what a GP could offer.
Oh, okay.
Not sure whether they need any support. So I'm most concerned that they don't get enough support in that situation, because they don't know what testing they need. They don't know what advice they should get for testing for their donor. They might not know about the timing with the inseminations and how to detect ovulation. So they're all just really helpful things to avoid wasting everyone's time and finding it a year later. You've been trying with this known donor for so long and it turned out you were trying at the wrong time, or he wasn't fertile, or you're putting yourself at risk because there was some issues around STIs. So, you know, I think it's really important to just get a bit of basic medical care.
And that's the thing. I went online in researching this show just to know what kind of questions to ask in this area. And my goodness, the amount of misinformation and mixture of information between people that are based overseas and here in Australia, it was actually really frightening. And a lot of that stuff, I've kind of learnt that just from the fertility, you know, Dr. Ann Polinis is coming in as our fertility specialist to be giving that advice. And you're just like, oh my God, people are they not thinking about this?
Yeah. I think for people who want to keep it natural and avoid the expense and the sort of interference of the medical system, I totally understand that. You know, I think they sort of go too far and say, well, I'm not going to go anywhere. But really, if it's just a matter of seeing a GP who understands this process, getting a bit of advice, you're still basically doing it yourself at home. It's still very intimate and private, and, you know, that's fantastic. And then the other advantage is that you've then got a time frame, because I would tell people, look, you know, give yourself 6 cycles of inseminations at the right time.
Yeah.
If that hasn't worked after 6 cycles, then please come back, because there are other things we can initiate, you know, a little bit of the next level of fertility testing, for example, to make sure there's nothing going wrong or nothing that needs a quick fix, you know, whatever. There are lots of things that can be overcome, fertility issues that are temporary or whatever. So, you know, people need to, I guess, have a sense of how long to try before they need to then seek a bit more help.
So obviously when it comes to the do-it-yourself thing at home, it's still quite a common practice and still quite popular.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's been some research done. I think Jen Power did some research recently on what methods people use for creating their families in LGBT community, and at least a third are still using insemination at home. That's about what I've found in a couple of the studies I've been involved with in the last 15 years, so it hasn't changed much, regardless of what's available in terms of access to clinics. There's still that cohort of people who just want to be, you know, independent.
Apart from our attempt to educate the public as best as we can with our show, are there certain websites that you recommend that people do visit that give the correct information, apart if they want to look it up themselves before coming to a GP?
Yeah, I think Rainbow Families Victoria has been really good over the years at updating their website with some health information, and also they've got a really good section on the legal issues, so that's reliable. We've had, at one point, the Royal Women's Hospital did a really good pamphlet called Pride and Joy, designed initially by Meg Golden, who's a fantastic worker there, a lesbian as well. So that was available for a long time, and I think we've had some discussions with them about getting that online so that there is readily accessible information for people who want to do this at home.
Yeah.
And that's not out there at the moment, but hopefully will be soon, or, you know, in the next few months, last years.
Well,
right. I mean, it is a plethora of information out there, a lot of which is quite confusing and contradictory, and a lot of it's American. No offence to the Americans, but the system is very different here.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah. And that's coming straight from Michelle, who is an American, going, yeah, no.
I mean, look, for myself, we're trying to go through transition as a trans woman. I mean, the plethora of information I've read out there, and the different things and different ideas and the different advice, the different whatever. I mean, it did my head in, and I actually went and just did everything myself, going and trying to find the right GP. I think I initially came to Northside, eventually found my GP that I clicked with. But, you know, again, I can only imagine the amount of things that would be there for this as well. That were just, like you said, we were talking about frozen. We were talking about, you know, what, you do an ice cube? Like, what do you do
I
with that?
I would never, you know, go. And because the frozen sperm, it's such just, everyone just says it. You would assume that if you had to transport, like a bad ankle, you put it on ice. Like, how would you not? And that's the thing.
It would be the worst thing you could do, because it's going to kill it off.
There you go.
Yeah,
you
know? But I could see somebody trying to do that and then putting a cold frozen sperm cube in themselves and going, oh, you know, what kind of, you know, effects would that cause to somebody?
And do you think the main reason people are, one of the key factors that people stay away from clinics is it is really expensive. Clinic, IUI, even as the cheaper option, is still very expensive and out of reach for people.
Yeah, like it's, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 per cycle of IUI, intrauterine insemination, and that's after you've had all the costs of the tests and donor think that is out of reach for a lot of people.
And Medicare benefits don't kick in unless you can show you're infertile, which means you've got to have a few attempts.
Yep.
I can understand why people would have a go at home. If you know your donor and you're going that path, it just makes financial sense, good sense.
It can work very well. I mean, I think the other legal issue, and you probably covered this on other shows, but just if it is a home insemination with a known donor, there's some issues around proving or confirming that the donor is not a parent.
Yeah.
So birth, death, the marriages are pretty okay with this now. All you have to do is produce a letter from the donor that says he is a donor, he's agreed not to be on the birth certificate. This is his contact details to go on the donor register, and then birth, death, and marriages are happy and they won't insist that he's on the birth certificate. So, you know, that's just a legal safeguard, I guess, particularly for the non-birth mother who may well want to be on the birth certificate as a second parent.
Yeah.
I'd say get the letter first before you kind of get the sample.
yeah.
Clearly, it's so easy to just go and see the right GP, and, you know, there is good information out there to find the right GP that will service your needs. And there's clinics like the Northside Clinic that can assist and refer people. But if there is one bit of takeaway advice that you kind of, one of the most common things you probably see people and go, oh, I wish you just came in earlier so I could tell you this. Is there one bit of cherry advice you'd like to either give to a female going through this or even a donor considering this?
I think the main thing is ovulation. You know, I mean, we don't understand our bodies well. That's a really common thing. People don't know when they're ovulating. So that is a crucial thing. You've got to get your timing right.
Yeah, I don't know how. I haven't seen myself ovulate in a while. So
it is, and I'm someone, and you know, I'm giving a lot of information out to our audience. I don't have a regular cycle. It would be almost impossible for me to track that sort of stuff.
You know, that's exactly right. A lot of people I see, you know, they've actually tried to do this, tried LH tests, and they just can't find it. So, you know, that's the time when I would initiate a bit more testing, work out why the cycle is irregular, and then I'd probably refer to fertility specialists.
Yeah.
So it's people like you, Gina. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just, you know, there are simple ways for some people to regulate the cycle, and then you can go ahead and do it at home. And the other thing I often do is refer people to women's health naturopaths if they're a bit irregular or their cycle is not quite right, because with some very simple herbal treatments that are tailored to the individual, they can regulate it really nicely.
And I could see it'd be women like Gina who'd have the irregular cycle who'd be like, okay, I'll see you on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We're going to do an injection every night until something sticks.
Then goodbye, donor, because he's just exhausted.
Yeah, he's exhausted.
Happen in one go. The poor donors, they don't get women's fertility. Like, why would they have had to before?
Yeah.
And so there's a bit of education to be done around, okay, this might take a while. You know, it might take more than one cycle. We might be calling on you every month for 6 months or longer.
But the thing is he couldn't be doing it every day. He'd actually have to let it go a couple of days before he would have a decent enough sample to go with it.
Does that matter? Would he need to be holding off?
Well, when I was told I had to do testing, I had to go and hold off from shaking hands with myself when we were trying to do testing because Belle couldn't get pregnant.
Okay.
Yeah. And well, that's right. So the optimal sample is 72 hours after the last ejaculation because it takes that long for the sperm to build up again. So 3 days is ideal. Another reason why, if you do it every day for several days, you're going to get less and less quality of sperm as you go along.
The life issues that, well, matter. Family Matters on Joy 94.9.
You've been listening to Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families, sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au, a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au.
Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.